Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
AFA Action takes attacks on the family seriously. The enemies of the family constantly employ new tactics to try to sneak past our radar. They know if we stand together, their evil plans will fail. Your gift to AFA Action allows us to stay vigilant against their onslaught. And if you give this month, you'll receive access to the Cultural Institute video, When Your Faith is Illegal, by Frank Harbor on AFA Stream as our thanks. You can make your gift today at afaaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, October 29th, and as you may have heard in the news break, if you're listening live, Vice President J.D. Vance and Erica Kirk, of course, Charlie Kirk's widow, will be at Ole Miss tonight doing a Turning Point USA event. This is very highly anticipated, and some of our American Family Radio reporters will be there as well. So we'll join tomorrow morning, and we will break down that conversation. And I think it's great that that Vice President Vance is so engaged with Turning Point because of his late friend Charlie Kirk. And I just think that's a wonderful expression of friendship and of carrying on the mission. So I plan to watch that this evening, and I hope that you will too. I know that Turning Point will be streaming it, and I'm also told based on reports that Jesse Watters from Fox News is going to be there and kind of carry his show live from there. So you can, of course, tune into Fox if you prefer. But that will be a great event. And so so while we have Turning Point and there's kind of this rise from the right of hopefully revival and truth of promotion of the gospel of Christ, Vox is reporting, and I think actually correctly, unfortunately, the headline is the GOP's anti-Semitism crisis. And the underline is Nick Fuentes, Tucker Carlson, and the looming Republican civil war over the Jews. This headline was actually a couple of days ago, and it was a little bit predictive of the controversy that shaped the news this morning, which is that Tucker Carlson platformed Nick Fuentes and did this kind of broad-ranging interview that was not an interview actually wanting to say, okay, what do you actually believe? And let's get to the root of why you believe that, so that he could kind of shine a light and a mirror into who Nick Fuentes is. It was totally a fluff kind of interview. And it was what we would call platforming. And before we get to this, if you're not familiar with Nick Fuentes, he is a very, very controversial figure on the quote-unquote far right. I'm not really sure if I would categorize him necessarily on the right, because I don't really think he is all that conservative. But he's basically loosely connected with a network of very anti-Semitic, Christian nationalist, if we want to kind of use the TM term for that, which is, of course, become sort of a term of art for people who are seeking to advance what they consider conservative policies, but very, very, very extreme. And this is someone who our friend Dinesh D'Souza actually put out text messages between himself and Charlie Kirk when Dinesh had a debate with Nick Fuentes on his positions on Israel and the Jews and this whole controversy. And Charlie was very upset about it, because he basically accused Dinesh of platforming Nick Fuentes and saying, you know, we're trying to marginalize him, sideline him, not give him a bigger voice because what he's saying is so damaging to the overall movement. And I'm just quoting what Charlie said in this text message that I've no reason to disbelieve Dinesh that this isn't accurate. He called Nick Fuentes vermin. Basically meaning kind of the lowest of the low. This is not someone that you want to even engage with at all and definitely do not want to amplify. Well, in my view, and watching Dinesh, who loves to debate and who loves to engage, as Charlie did, the purpose of that debate was because Nick Fuentes had consistently called out people like Ben Shapiro and Charlie Kirk. There's a whole history, if you're interested in, you know, going deep down the rabbit hole, between Nick Fuentes and his followers and Turning Point USA. And so, you know, Nick was saying that Charlie refused to debate him and was scared of him. So basically, Dinesh is saying, you know, listen, I'm not scared of you. I'm not scared of anti-Semitic views. I'm not scared of the ideology. I disagree with it. And so I'm going to debate you in order to show and expose why your views are wrong and why people should not actually follow you. And in my opinion, that is a valid and legitimate reason to engage with someone who unfortunately does have as wide-reaching of a platform and a very, very young audience. This is somebody who, like Charlie, engages with people, with young people, and is telling them what to think and what to believe about issues, particularly on Israel. And so that kind of back and forth and that debate actually exposes what Nick Fuentes is saying and is giving people who listen an opportunity to maybe think, you know, why am I listening to him? I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same reason why on this show I had to cover Candace Owens last week and some of her absolutely ridiculous, utter nonsense. And it's not about platforming her or making her more popular. It's about exposing what she's saying that is false. And that kind of engagement, when someone is as influential as Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes, that's okay. I mean, and the number one rule of debate generally, and you know, you learn this kind of in the political sphere, is you never want to engage in a debate with somebody who has a much, much lower media ID than you. That's kind of the rule in DC. I tend to generally agree with that in the sense that I don't want to platform someone or give someone an audience who otherwise isn't really all that known, especially if they have very false and maybe even extremist, and we can use that word, views. But when somebody is already as unfortunately mainstream on the right as Nick Fuentes, to me, it's actually a very good thing to engage his views directly and to do exactly what Dinesh did, which was to confront them. And debating is confronting those ideas. And you don't have to do it in a mean-spirited way. You don't have to do it in a harsh, unloving way. In fact, Dinesh was complimentary of Nick's debate style and saying, you know, this was actually a well-ordered conversation. And Dinesh got a lot of blowback for that because people were saying, you're complimenting him. How dare you? You know, and he's going, I'm not complimenting his ideas. I'm saying that he came to the table willing to discuss his ideas. And that's exactly what Charlie Kirk believed in general, which is why it's somewhat surprising to me that he would be so against Dinesh going into that forum. But that's one whole piece of it. But that is so completely opposite to what Tucker Carlson did last night, because what Tucker Carlson did was platform Nick Fuentes. And platforming is very different than debating. Platforming is bringing someone onto your network, your show, exposing them to your audience in a way that amplifies them, gives them a megaphone, is basically encouraging them, is telling your listeners like, wow, this is somebody that you should listen to, that you should follow. I do a lot of platforming. Platforming is not actually a bad thing. It is a good thing. I use this radio show to platform people that I think that you, the American Family Radio audience, should hear from, and people that maybe you haven't yet been exposed to, that I'm saying these are great people, and I want to use the platform that God has given me to further amplify them, to give them a megaphone because I love what they're saying. That's probably, you know, 98% of the people that I bring onto this show, I am purposefully and intentionally trying to platform. That's a good thing. That's where we all collectively say we are going to further advance good ideas and further advance people who are speaking truth and who are doing great things in policy. Maybe we don't agree with them on every single issue, but on the things that we overlap, you know, this is a great way that they're making a difference in America for the truth of the kingdom of God. That's a good way of platforming. But what Tucker did was platform Nick Fuentes in a way that not only amplified his message, but seemed to totally agree with it. And in fact, Tucker Carlson went so far as to say in this interview that he thinks that Christian Zionism is Christian heresy. Basically, if you believe that Israel is entitled, the nation of Israel is entitled to their land under the Genesis covenant, then he thinks that you are a Christian heretic, and he thinks that you are the most disliked of the people that he knows and interacts with. And he even named a few of them. You can guess, you know, Ted Cruz. But listen to what Tucker Carlson had to say. This is cut one.
How do you explain Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, and there are a lot like that, John Bolton. I mean, I've known them all. George W. Bush, like Karl Rove. I mean, all people I know personally who I've seen, like, be seized by this brain virus, mm-hmm. and they're not Jewish. Most of them are self-described Christians, and then the Christian Zionists mm-hmm. who are, well, Christian Zionists. Like, what is that?
Right.
And I can just say for myself, I dislike them more than anybody, you know, because like what? Because it's Christian heresy, and I'm offended by that as a Christian. That's why. So I don't like. Why not? Like, I'm pissed at the neocons. I've said that a million times. I've been mad since December of 2003 when I went to Iraq. And so like I went and asked straightforward questions to Ted Cruz because that seemed like he was a sitting senator who's like serving for Israel by his own description. He seemed like a worthy target. I'm not going after MTG, mm-hmm. who's like the most sincere like, why not go after Ted Cruz?
So he goes on to talk about this and he's evoking that what we spent a lot of time on the show breaking down that interview between Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson, which that was more of a debate. And if you remember, I mean, Tucker Carlson basically didn't even give Ted Cruz an opportunity to say to actually express his belief and express anything that he was trying to get across. It was very hostile. It was completely different than the interview with Nick Fuentes. And this is obviously because Tucker Carlson has a viewpoint and he has a position. And we need to talk about the position that Tucker Carlson has, the position that Nick Fuentes has, which you all who regularly listen to this show know that I completely disagree with that. Obviously, I am very much pro-Israel. I believe that the Bible, it says that God gave the land to Israel. He has not revoked that covenant. And the nation of Israel is entitled to the land that God gave them. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to, we as the nation of the United States of America have to agree with absolutely everything that the nation of Israel does in terms of their policy and supporting them financially and so forth. That's the policy that we can debate. But we can't debate what God has already provided for. And that's not Christian heresy. And I love what Mike Huckabee wrote in response to Tucker Carlson saying this. He just said, oh, wow, you know, how will I go on? Basically, I had no idea that Tucker Carlson didn't like me, but, you know, oh well. And it was kind of, you know, just brushing it off. But this is causing a major fracture within the GOP. And this is why I spent so much time on this. And I brought on Orrin McIntyre, who generally I bring on because I agree with him. But that was a debate because he's someone who I believe is approaching this in good faith, but has a different opinion on the U.S. supporting Israel and so forth. And we need to hear those contrasting perspectives, right? But the whole bottom line to this and why this is a controversy is that it is very, very insidious when people that generally have been otherwise respectable conservatives and have been mainstream for a long time, like Tucker Carlson, are not debating and exposing and engaging people like Nick Fuentes for the purpose of showing you, the audience, why you should not follow them, why you should not believe them, why you should reject their anti-Semitic views, why you need to say they should not have as big of a following as they do. But rather platforming and amplifying them and handing them a megaphone. So we need to, as Christian conservatives, be very, very discerning, because even people who have been otherwise previously, you know, good conservatives. I mean, I used to watch, I was on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News quite frequently. He's a friend. And he used to be, you know, very mainstream, and I'd listen to him and agree with a lot of what he said. But he has gone so far down this rabbit hole of being very pro-Qatar, very anti-Israel, and platforming and amplifying people that the right and conservatives and Christians absolutely should not. And so when we look at people like Tucker Carlson, like Candace Owens, like Nick Fuentes, just because they have a following does not mean we cannot critically analyze what they're saying, who they platform, and who they engage with. Always be discerning in who you are listening to, because even people who historically may have had a good perspective, had a good show, one thing, I mean, they can get off into a rabbit hole that utterly destroys their credibility and, in my view, utterly destroys the worthiness of listening to them. Now Tucker may have a good guest or, you know, a worthwhile show later on in the future. That may be well and good. But as far as I'm concerned, I have marginalized him into the realm of someone that I no longer listen to, and I don't put into the category of overall solid conservative figures. And this is why there were so many people who were very frustrated with Tucker Carlson being at Charlie Kirk's memorial service. Now, that to me was a little bit different because I know that Charlie and Tucker were friends. And at a memorial service, that's not really the time to get, you know, political, other than a Turning Point USA event, probably, right? But that's why, because people are very concerned, just like how people don't want Candace Owens at further Turning Point events. And in my personal opinion, and Charlie knew this, he and I had many conversations personally about this. The one thing that I disagreed with Charlie Kirk about overall was how many people he platformed and was willing to say, let's bring into the overall big tent of conservatism. I think that you have to draw your borders and boundaries of conservatism and who we include in the overall right in terms of our leaders a lot more carefully. Now, you can vote Republican all day. You can vote for conservatism all day if you want to, no matter who you are, what you think, what you believe, fine. But whoever we platform and establish as leaders and say, yes, this is who we are engaging in terms of our movement, that we have to be a lot more discerning of. And I think in terms of the people that Charlie allowed to be Turning Point USA ambassadors were not people that should have been amplified based on You know, what they posted on social media, photos of, you know, women in bikinis holding their AR-15s. That's not conservatism. That's not somebody you want as a brand ambassador, as someone saying, you know, this is someone who is a face of our brand. And there's been a lot of problems at Turning Point because of some of those ambassadors. So this is where, again, we have to be very discerning. And I hope that Turning Point, as much as I am so for them, and I am so for Turning Point USA, and I want them to continue on doing the mission of Charlie Kirk, which is engaging in the debate and the dialogue, we have to recognize that there is a distinction between debate and engaging and showing the falsity of certain viewpoints and worldviews. Even people who may vote for us or who may say they're a conservative Christian, we still need to have proper definitions. And there's a difference between that type of engagement versus platforming, amplifying, and especially who we allow to represent us as our leaders. So we'll take a break here and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is a great piece in The Federalist that you absolutely need to read. And the headline is "The United Nations Finally Recognizes Homeschooling by Demanding the Government Ruin It." And this is written by our good friend Mike Donnelly, who is someone that I'm absolutely platforming because I think that you need to listen to him and follow him at Donnelly Speaks, so on X. So let's welcome him in now. He is an attorney and just a phenomenal writer. And it's been a minute since you've had a piece in The Federalist, but you know, this is a really important issue. So welcome in, Mike, and let's break this down.
Well, good morning, Jenna. Good morning to everyone listening. I hope you are off to a great start this morning. Yeah, if you call a minute 5 years, it's been a minute. Yeah, the last time I published something in The Federalist was 5 years ago during the coronavirus pandemic. I was working at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, which I have subsequently moved on from, and working at another great conservative organization, the Club for Growth, where we are advancing conservative values and freedom and America. But while I was there advocating for homeschooling freedom all around the world as the director for global outreach for HSLDA, I had the opportunity to connect up with the United Nations, which I've never been a fan of. But I always knew that if homeschooling was going to flourish, it needed to be advocated for even at places like the UN, because unlike in the United States, other countries actually care what the United Nations says and does. You know, we don't really so much here, at least not in conservative circles, and we shouldn't. But anyway, they decided they were going to have a look at homeschooling through a human rights lens. And I've written a lot about this over the years. I went to the London School of Economics, actually, to get a degree after my JD. I got an LLM in international human rights law, which I teach at the law school level even now, because I want to understand how people on that side who look at everything through, quote unquote, human rights, whereas we look at things through constitutional rights, I wanted to know how they thought about these issues. And I was surprised by what I found, which is that actually when you go back to the very beginning of the United Nations, the original United Nations Declaration of Human Rights and some of the original treaties that the United Nations drafted right after World War II, there's some pretty good language in there which I write about in this article. But what the UN has done is it has released a report, its first ever, not comprehensive, but one of the longest report it's ever written on homeschooling. And shocker, you know, it calls on governments to regulate homeschooling, because with the United Nations, everything is about government control. Everything, every solution to every problem is more government, more regulation, and more control. And while I participated in the group of experts on this report by giving them input, my input was always, no, that's not what human rights requires. No, you shouldn't call for governments to control and regulate homeschooling, because that will be the death knell of what homeschooling is all about. Homeschooling is about freedom. It's about giving children freedom. It's about families having freedom to pursue the life that they want to pursue. And of course, that's a threat to government, and it's a threat to, you know, the values that underpin the modern United Nations, which is all about government control. So yeah, thank you, Federalists, for publishing this article. And I encourage folks to go have a look at it. If you go to my X account at Donnelly Speaks, I've got it posted there, and you can find it pretty easily.
Yeah, and the headline again is United Nations finally recognizes homeschooling by demanding government ruin it. Love that headline. And of course, I'm speaking with Mike Donnelly, who is the author of this article. And you have over the years, you know, taught me a lot about what the international legal view is, or and what it should and shouldn't be about this term human rights, because we hear this all the time from the left, and that is kind of their favorite terminology, human rights, civil rights, and often that is contrasted. They don't want to use the term natural rights or God-given rights, and that becomes really problematic when we talk about government regulation and government control, because if human rights or civil rights are something that are arbitrarily manufactured by a consensus, whether that's the United Nations, that's a state government, that's the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, whatever it is, then it's basically just a privilege and something that the government can step in and moderate however they see fit, instead of a fundamental natural right like what parents have to direct the upbringing and education of their children. And so from kind of a big picture perspective, what is the working definition of human rights according to the United Nations and basically the left that's problematic?
Well, you're right, Jenna. You know, post-World War II, the world came together and said, we can't let this happen again. We've got to put a stake in the ground about what we think human rights are. And they did. That's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, there's some things in there that I don't agree with, because they come from this positive rights viewpoint, which is antithetical to the natural rights construct, where our rights come from God. When you think about rights as positive rights, it's something the government must give you, as opposed to negative rights, which is we must prevent the government from doing to us. Okay, and that's the basic viewpoint of the United States Constitution, you know, and our view that, as James Madison wrote in Federalist 51, you know, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. But we know men are not angels, and so we have to limit government power. We have to separate powers, which is what our Constitution does, to protect our freedoms, because we know that human beings are sinners, and ultimately governments and people will try to centralize power so they can control other people, okay? And that's kind of what human rights has become, because if you can categorize something as a right, well, now all of a sudden government says, well, if there's a right, then somebody has to have a duty to provide for that right, like health care, like food, right? I mean, look what we're having an argument about here in the United States today. The SNAP, so-called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps, is about to not be funded. You know, and I've heard people saying, and I love this, if you give government the power to feed you, you give government the power to starve you. And this is what human rights becomes. If you everything is a right, then everything is a hook for government to control everything. And that is completely antithetical to what our founders believed, to freedom, and to the idea that God creates rights and governments are created among men to protect rights. So we've got a big job ahead of us in this country to kind of recover that view that rights are natural. And as I write in the article, you know, the homeschooling is kind of a recognition of everything that's great about America. It's self-governance, it's freedom, It's people deciding themselves how they're going to order their lives. And that's what this country was founded on. So, you know, and the United Nations is saying, no, we have to control that. So very problematic. But read it at The Federalist. And thank you, Federalist. And thank you, Jenna, for giving me a chance to talk about it this morning.
Yeah, and I think the key there is to say that the view of rights should be that the government is obligated to protect those rights, not to provide for them. That's the key difference, because when we think about protection versus provision, protecting rights is all about saying, okay, we all have then equal opportunity. We can go and speak without being censored. We can go and freely exercise our religious beliefs rather than having the government infringe upon them. But it's not to say that the government needs to provide opportunity for me or to give me living assistance or to say or to command which viewpoint I must speak on or to compel me or to provide a platform. I mean, all of this is so... All of this to the left, it's completely being turned on its head. And you're absolutely right that in this current debate, even the government shutdown right now, that's the key difference between conservatives and communists, basically. And the left is to say that the government, through more taxing of the people, we should take everything from everybody and redistribute wealth so that everybody basically is equal. And that becomes government provision. And that's not the proper and correct or biblical or natural understanding of rights. Because, I mean, even if you look at individuals and aptitudes, people are very different in terms of what they're capable of, what even their desires are, what their opportunities that are presented. I mean, people have opportunities that I'll never have in my life, and I've had opportunities that other people will never have. And that's okay, because we're all different. And that kind of difference is good. Difference is also not the same thing as diversity in terms of what the left is projecting. And so when we're talking, though, about this whole idea of the United Nations trying to overregulate, there's also a danger. And you mentioned, you know, like the UN Convention on Rights to the Child and, you know, some of these other things in terms of overriding even the U.S. Constitution in terms of how the U.S. government is protecting of the fundamental rights that are God-given and natural, where there is really a danger that the United Nations and some of these other kind of international conventions, if we are part of some of these treaties as the United States, will try to undermine our own sovereignty so that our government then isn't able to protect our rights as much as it otherwise should.
That's true. Article 6 of our Constitution makes treaties that we enter into the supreme law of the land equal to the Constitution itself. So look, folks, this is not a small thing. That's why the United States needs to be very cautious about entering into treaties. Treaties were never intended to regulate these kinds of things, by the way, under, you know, thousands of years of international law. The idea of international law is the relationships between states on the open seas or war, conventions of war, how states deal with each other, not about regulating the internal conduct of states. But that's what the human rights movement is about. It's about using international legal mechanisms that they create through treaties, through international bodies like the criminal, International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court, where they try to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu for so-called war crimes. And then they advance their own view of human rights about this favored group versus that favored group. Or we think that, you know, we're going to, you know, recognize the right to abortion, and that's a human right, which is ridiculous, right? And so that's what is the danger. And our Constitution actually provides that a treaty ratified by the Senate is the supreme law of the land. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's basically what it says. So we need to be very careful about getting involved with international treaties like the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which the U.S. has never ratified, thanks to the homeschooling community who pushed back against it and other smart people, or the UN Convention on the Rights to Persons with Disabilities, which sounds great, but we already have laws in our own country about how we treat people with disabilities, and much better than any UN convention, right? And so what we need to do is recognize that our Constitution is great. Other people can run their countries the way they want to, but we need to be very cautious, very suspect, I would say, about international law, international treaties, and signing up to them. And, you know, when you look at the way the UN wants to treat homeschooling, that's just another example.
Yeah, really well said. Well, we have to break here. There's so much more that we can and will talk about with Mike Donnelly on this. And I've been talking to him and having this conversation for, you know, over a decade now, because it's really fascinating. And it also is so important that we don't just understand what our U.S. Constitution says, but also what we sign on to with treaties, because he's absolutely right with Article 6 and how treaties can become part of our supreme law of the land. And we need to be very, very careful what we sign on to in this country. This is why foreign policy matters, but this is why understanding circumspectly as conservative constitutionalists what we sign on to, what we agree to, because we need to maintain that difference and always be advocates for protecting our God-given rights, not obliging the government to provide for them. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and great news from AFA, and this just came out yesterday. AFA secures major development in Apple communication safety for children. So about 2 years ago, the American Family Association decided to use our investment portfolio to promote pro-family proposals with some of America's biggest publicly traded companies. In the past year alone, we have spoken to shareholders, board members, and executives of Schwab, Apple, John Deere, Intel, and Verizon. And in part of our research into Apple's policies, we uncovered that Apple's communication safety is enabled by default on devices of children under age 13. But for teens 14 to 17, these safety features were disabled by default. So what does that mean? Children under 13 are protected from harmful content, including pornographic images in their iMessage app, and children aged 14 to 17 are not protected from such content. So why would a company not have a universal safety standard that protects all children? Well, AFA got involved, and there is now a significant win at Apple. So joining me now to discuss this is our general counsel here at the American Family Association, the great Abraham Hamilton III, who also hosts the Hamilton Corner right here on American Family Radio Network. And so Apple has now changed its policy, Abe.
Yeah, that's a great development. Walker Wildman was a part of the point person on this, on our side, working with our CFO, Walter Billingsley, and Jerry Boyer from Boyer Research. And what you said is exactly right. We used our shareholder stance with Apple in particular to gain an audience with them, and then made a proposal to them because they had a default setting when the parental controls were enabled, which means that when you have your Apple iPhone or iPad and you set up your device, you include identifying information usually. And so when that identifying information was included for children 13 and under, they would apply this default protection to keep pornographic images and things of that nature away from being disseminated via iMessages, which is for Apple users, you understand that you have the capacity to send messages on an internal Apple communication system other than open source code like other non-Apple products. And so Walker asked the question very simply, said, well, why would you include it as a default for children 13 and under and not include all minors universally? That led to a shareholder proposal, then a dialogue with Apple, and then ultimately Apple agreed with our position and said, no, we will include that default for all parental control settings for all minors, which is a big win.
Yeah, that is a real victory for family and children. And this also shows the power of shareholder activism and speaking truth, because a lot of times, you know, and even here at AFA, I mean, we have certainly encouraged boycotts in certain circumstances, obviously, but this is different than that when we have then, you know, shareholder opportunities to say, hey, as a shareholder and as a stakeholder, this affects us. And so we have a voice and we have input rather than simply, you know, telling parents, OK, just don't buy Apple products, because obviously some minors are still going to engage with these types of products. So where do you see that line between kind of the power of shareholder activism and speaking truth versus, you know, when we ask for boycotts and speaking truth in that lane?
Yeah, usually in AFA's history, boycotts have been a last resort. Sometimes people don't realize the boycott has followed numerous communication efforts to engage these corporations directly and to persuade them with reason and with scripture and with a direct appeal, and the boycott is the last effort. And so it really is an all-hands-on-deck approach. In this instance, the communications with Apple became fruitful, and so it didn't result in a full-fledged boycott, because the question was simply put, if you have these protections for minors under ages 13 and under, can you articulate why you would not include the same protections for all minors? You know, and ultimately, Apple had to come to the realization that, yeah, we don't really have a good reason not to include this for all minors as a default mechanism. Now, I do want to say something. For Apple users, it requires vigilant parents to initiate the parental controls. You know, so you had the wherewithal, and Apple has it. We have a press release we released on this, and we've sent emails out to our supporters on this with a direct link to the instructions that Apple has provided to notify parents, first of all, and secondarily walk them through how you can implement these parental controls. But once you do this as parents, it will require a passcode that the parents have in order to access the type of information and type of stuff that, you know, you and I and we at AFA certainly recognize that minors shouldn't have access to. Nobody, frankly, should have access to this stuff. And one of the sad realities of living in this pornographic society that these smart devices, smartphones, and things of that nature have been a major vehicle for communication, frankly, of child pornography. And so seeing Apple ultimately, after, as you mentioned, after 2 years of engagement, to finally acknowledge that we were right and they agreed to make these adjustments, this is a big step in the right direction for families.
Yeah, and it's really amazing to me that it even took 2 years. I mean, because you would think that that these protections that weren't extended to minors 14 to 17 would have posed legal exposure for Apple under, you know, either child endangerment or privacy statutes, or, you know, so, I mean, so this is surprising that Apple would have even allowed this in the first place.
Yeah, it is, and, you know, we're living in a fallen world. To say that they even needed someone to say, hey, this should be made accessible to all, this should be made prohibited to all minors, shows that there simply is a worldview divergence, which is why I continue to assert that we want an all-hands-on-deck approach. We need, for example, people engaged in the civic arena and advocating for sound policies. We need individuals and organizations like ours engaging corporations to have biblically compatible and pro-family policies. But ultimately, in addition to all of those things, we need people on the ground proclaiming the Lord's gospel and making disciples for heart and mind transformation in order for us to enjoy what the scripture says in Hebrews, the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So it cannot be either or. It has to be an all hands on deck approach, as I alluded to earlier. We need sound policies. We need corporations to be responsive to shareholders and customers and to family. But and we need disciples to be made. That is a key component in order for us to move in the direction we need to move in as a country.
Yeah, amen to that. And I'm speaking with Abraham Hamilton III, who is the host of the Hamilton Corner here on American Family Radio Network, and our AFA General Counsel. And this highlights why policy is so important, even for private corporations. I mean, often when we talk about policy, our default is to consider government policy and government regulation and government intervention and, you know, how and state and federal elections. And that all of that is incredibly important. But I think this win highlights how we have to be engaged in the private sector as well, because that is just as important. I mean, the policies that these companies are setting have just as much of an impact on families and children as government policies values do. And so could this new Apple precedent influence how other major tech companies like maybe Google, Meta, TikTok, you know, all of these other companies handle child safety defaults, their own internal standards without having to have, you know, the government come in and enforce some of these regulations?
You're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that we're looking forward to seeing happen, because as you know, corporations tend to be copycat in certain areas. And so when you see such a major player in the tech space like Apple making this adjustment and making it publicly, you know, they issued press releases and indicating their changes and making these changes publicly, we expect that to have a similar influence on these other corporations, including but not limited to what you referred to earlier, a potential legal exposure. Because now that Apple has made this available, you know, with all kinds of negligence cases and child endangerment and the reasonable man standard, that they can no longer say, hey, we were unaware that these things were happening. Say, no, you're aware because one of the major competitors made a major adjustment and made that adjustment publicly. So that would serve notice to competitors in the same space that this type of things, particularly child sexual abuse material and child pornography, is being disseminated. And then you have minors who are, frankly, unlawfully consuming this information. You are now on notice that you should probably consider and make adjustments in your policies and your devices as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, this hopefully is another turning point showing that faith-based engagement with corporations can lead to real moral change. I mean, there are a lot of Christians that unfortunately still have the perspective that, you know, politics and policy and some of this, you know, we as Christians shouldn't engage in. We just need to be out there, you know, teaching Christ in our communities and being in church. That is all true, that we need to be engaged in church. But we also need to be engaged in civil society, because when you have this kind of faith-based engagement, as you just mentioned, Abe, I mean, Apple had no real answer to that question of why doesn't this policy cover the 14 to 17 year olds? And this is bringing about a real moral change, and we may never know the actual benefit and the basically the net positive of how this will impact kids who may have otherwise been exposed at a very young age to harmful material. And this is exactly why AFA does engage in this type of policy. And it's so important for Christians to understand that we can influence.
Absolutely. You know, to draw from Michael Jordan's quote, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. You know, and in God and his divine providence has ordained us to live in a nation that we have as a governmental structure, a constitutional republic with democratic features. And so God and his divine providence would expect no less of us than he expected of the Apostle Paul, being keenly aware of his Roman citizenship, appealing to that citizenship to get access to Caesar, and then ultimately proclaiming the gospel to Caesar. The Lord would expect no less than from us to use everything at our disposal to be salt and light. That being in the citizens in the constitutional republic, that we have the most robust economy in the world, corporations play such a huge role in our civic society that we, I would argue, have a duty to engage them in such a manner to where we serve as in that salt light capacity, frankly, as a conscience source for society. Because had not this been presented to Apple, they never would have considered this on their own. They're the ones who set their default settings to allow 14 to 17 year olds to have that access. So it had to be presented to them in such a way that, as you mentioned, it was undeniable. And so over time, they recognized that and then made the adjustment and communicated that adjustment publicly.
Yeah, and this is exactly the type of approach that we need to take with every issue, is that over time, the reality and the truth just becomes undeniable. And this is how we start with these types of moral changes in society. And this is why I so appreciate everyone in the American Family Association family that helps us achieve these types of wins and continue this type of work, because it's so incredibly important. And in just about the last minute we have here, Abe Hamilton, what can ordinary families or churches do to help keep up the pressure on other companies to adopt similar standards, obviously other than supporting us here at AFA, because we will continue this work as well?
Yeah, in addition to, you know, supporting us and being aware, first of all, we should be engaged to know what is and what is not going on with our own children and on the devices that they have access to. But in addition to that, if you recognize you have devices, in this instance, certainly you have like Android and non-Apple products for tablets and iPhones, reach out to those companies, corporations, and corporations and say, hey, did you guys see what Apple just did? Do we have these protections on our devices? Concerning the text feature, Android devices have kind of the open source code, so it's a little bit different. They don't have the iMessage framework, but they have the text capacities, the image capacities, and they have the internet access capacities. And so people who own these devices and own these corporations' products and shares of stock should communicate directly with them their preferences and priorities.
Always use your influence. That's the bottom line. Thanks so much, Abe. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.